Well, good afternoon, everybody, on such a miserable day. Thanks for coming out. This is part of our 80th anniversary of World War II program. Those of you who attended the evening session a couple of weeks ago got a good understanding of the Air Force, in particular the centenary of the Permanent Air Force. So today it's the Navy's turn to talk about Forgotten on the Front Lines. Richard has spoken to us on a number of occasions before, and he's got a very good presentation today talking about the New Zealand cruisers in the Pacific from sort of around about 1942 to 45, which is a subject that's not well known and, as he says, probably forgotten. So over to you, Richard. Thank you very much.
Joe, thank you very much, and thank you all for attending. There's our start, and basically the first thing that was the inspiration for today is that it's in fact exactly the 80th anniversary of the Battle of Kolambangara, which I'm sure very few of you will have heard of. It wasn't one of the great success stories, as we'll go through, but nonetheless it was a significant event in the context of New Zealand's Navy. The other aspect, I suppose, is the flavour that with the attack on Pearl Harbor and the fall of Singapore, everything changed and we turned towards the Americans. And as you'll see in this talk, in fact, that might have been true at the kind of grand strategic level, but for the Royal New Zealand Navy in particular, but indeed for the armed forces as a whole, at that sort of operational and tactical level and certainly equipment-wise, we were in fact still and consistently beholden to the British. And so I'll cover the actions of our three particular cruisers. I'll touch on what the Australians did and why they became sort of distant halfway through the war from us. And just as a final comparison, I'll talk briefly about the Canadian cruisers, because at times if you look back at Canadian naval policy compared with New Zealand's, ours is coherent and logical, whereas the Canadians seem to struggle, forgetting that having to remember that they have more than just prairies, they do have an ocean on each side of them. So the Canadians can serve as a bad example. Anyway, as you see, the goal is 1942 to 45. That's a lot of territory to cover. It's a fairly narrow focus in terms of our cruisers, not the Navy as a whole. And there is, of course, a prologue. So for 2 years, 39 to the end of 41, there was a global naval war run by the Admiralty in London and obviously the navies of Canada, Australia, New Zealand, India, and the naval forces in South Africa, all took a part in this, and the guiding brain of the whole thing was the Admiralty in London. There were fleets, obviously the home fleet in the British waters, the Mediterranean fleet, the East Indies fleet, but in the more remote, as you might say, areas, then you had your naval stations, the Australia station, and in our case, the New Zealand station, controlled by the Naval Board in Wellington. And with the onset of war, the basic policy was we'll have one of our cruisers in home waters, that is the New Zealand station, which is pretty bloody big, and the other one deployed where the Admiralty needs it. And as you know, Achilles went to South America, fought in the Battle of the River Plate, and in February 1940 came home. So a couple of months later, Leander deployed for an even longer period to the Red Sea, Indian Ocean, Eastern Mediterranean, and saw some action there. And in the process of that, we agreed to man a third cruiser, HMS Neptune, which in fact was sunk before it could ever get out to the New Zealand station. So here's Leander in 1940, pretty much in her peacetime context, light grey overall, white topmast, white because they're hard to see against the horizon when you're looking through the gun sights of another ship. And the Red Sea, there was some fierce action against the Italians before the fall of Italian Somalia and the Abyssinian campaign. So Leander was earning her keep. And then just as I say, because of the Australians, when we talk in defence terms with Australia, generally the factor involved is either 20% or 25%, you know, one fifth, one fourth. But in the cruiser context, they started off with six cruisers. We started off with two, so there was a one third proportion. And as we'll talk, and as you can see, there's a couple of spoiler alerts in there. The heavy cruiser Canberra was lost in 1942, which we'll touch on. The light cruisers Sydney and Perth were lost. The cruiser Adelaide, which you may not have heard of, was in fact a World War I design that had been built in Australia. They liked to support their shipbuilding industry. So, of course, it took something like 3 or 4 years to build. And Adelaide was still running in 1939. Adelaide's biggest contribution, in fact, was she sailed to New Caledonia before Japan entered the war and helped convince that the local Gaullists could actually run New Caledonia and not the Vichy French supporters. So that, in fact, was actually an important strategic achievement. And I mentioned there merchant cruisers. The Australians had converted three of their liners with six-inch guns, etc. And we, of course, converted monowai. Now, as you will be aware, Japan's strategy in December 1941 was to go and capture the southern resources area, which is outlined in blue, basically the Dutch East Indies plus Malaya. Oil, rubber, all those sorts of good things, rice too, no doubt. So that was the prime purpose of the Japanese attack. There's a little dotted line to the right-hand side on the screen there, which is a carrier task force that incidentally raids Pearl Harbor, knocks out the battle line of the US Pacific Fleet. But that was just to protect their main purpose. Not many Americans realize this. They seem to think it all revolves around Pearl Harbor. But if in New Zealand you woke up on the morning of the 8th of December, things were unfolding in Malaya, Singapore, and the Philippines, Hong Kong, and incidentally, a couple of hours before dawn, our time, the carrier force had raided Pearl Harbor. So the international dateline is a little factor here, and again, Americans don't understand it. So as you'll see in my talk, it seems to me as I assemble this, there are four phases to the whole thing. So basically until the fall of Singapore, there's what I've described as ad hoc, which is really a polite way of saying bloody confusion for everybody. The Brits, the Dutch, the Americans in the Philippines, Australia, New Zealand. There was a lot happening. Everything was reactive to the Japanese advances. So in essence, from the beginning of the Pacific War until mid-1943, from the point of view of the Royal New Zealand Navy and its cruisers specifically, the goal was cooperation, indeed virtually integration, with the United States Navy. But from the middle of 43 until December 1944, we had to repair our ships. And so we turned, obviously, to the Brits. They were British-built ships. And that was the period that we acquired the Gambia. There is a certain parallel, as I'll say, that Australians wound up after losing Canberra, being given by the Brits another heavy cruiser, the Shropshire, which commissioned into the RAN as HMAS Shropshire. So there's a parallel there. And then for the final year of the war and into the immediate aftermath of 1946, the prime focus was the British Pacific Fleet. So you'll see already there's a flavour that the Brits were not forgotten. Indeed, they were essential to us. So here's Leander in the Brisbane River passing one of the Australian armed merchant cruisers. You can see a 6-inch gun mounted on the forecastle of the armed merchant cruiser. And Leander's obviously signalling by flashing light, and one anchor is ready for letting go. So after the big Japanese maritime blitzkrieg, then there was the second phase. What do the Japanese do after all their successes? There was, of course, a debate in Tokyo between the Army and the Navy, and Admiral Yamamoto, who commanded the combined fleet, he was not actually head of the Navy, per se, but probably the most influential admiral. His goal was to take Midway Island, force a battle with the remainder of the US Navy in the Pacific, and then they would march south or sailed south from the Solomon Islands into New Caledonia, the New Hebrides, Vanuatu today, Fiji, American Samoa, and that probably would have meant Western New Zealand, Samoa, and maybe all the way to Tonga. The goal there was to get those bases and cut off Australia from the American West Coast, which would have been a rather scary prospect. So let me talk briefly about command in all this period. Because, as I say, prior to the Pacific War breaking out, the Admiralty in London thought it controlled the world, and in a sense it did. But with the Japanese entry, it all changes. And so the initial reaction in roughly late January, February 1942, before Singapore falls, is to create over on the Dutch East Indies and Malaya area the ABDA command, Australia, British, Dutch, and American. And it was given to General Wavell, and it didn't last for very long, and it was an attempt to, it was probably the first of the great combined commands under the Allies in World War II. It was not a good example, but things were desperate. At the same time, on the eastern side of Australia, they drew some lines on the map and created the ANZAC area, which obviously was Australia, New Zealand, some of the American ships, and indeed the British offered the little aircraft carrier HMS Hermes to join the group. But as some of you may be aware, Hermes promptly got sunk off Ceylon in April 1942, so the British didn't contribute. And indeed, from the American point of view, who of course were very focused on defending Hawaii, threat to the American West Coast, and nobody quite knew what the Japanese were going to do next, because their code-breaking was still swinging into gear. The ANZAC area was a sort of an attempt to placate Australia and New Zealand, send them a few ships and destroyers, and let's hope we can actually get on top of the war in the Central Pacific. Well, again, this was a short-lived approach. And when General MacArthur escapes from the Philippines, sets himself up in Melbourne, and says to the Philippines, "I shall return," and of course there were political imperatives between MacArthur, a Republican, and Roosevelt, a Democrat, it served Roosevelt's purposes to keep General MacArthur far away in Australia. So the Southwest Pacific area was formed, which I'll show you in a moment. So that included Australia, New Guinea, Borneo, and the Philippines, and that was General MacArthur's area. And so the Australian Navy, or its cruisers, were formed into Task Force 44, the Australian ships, and USS Chicago and the miscellaneous destroyers. So at the same time as you cut off you create the Southwest Pacific area, Admiral Nimitz in Hawaii is given the rest of the Pacific Ocean, divided into three: North Pacific, Central, Hawaii and the Central Pacific Islands, and the South Pacific area. And the South Pacific area logically ran from the equator down to include New Zealand and all the traditional tropical islands, Tahiti, Samoa, etc. So the South Pacific area was a naval command, ultimately under Admiral Nimitz. And then the final thing I'll remark on is that it wasn't until March 1943 that the US Navy, which as you can appreciate was expanding, formed its numbered fleets. And so MacArthur's Navy became the 7th Fleet, and the Nimitz had the Navy in the Pacific numbered as the 5th Fleet and given command to Admiral Spruance. So from this point, the RAM cruisers belong to the 7th Fleet, and so their operations tend to be separate and unlinked to anything that the New Zealand ships did, which were part of the South Pacific area and under Admiral Nimitz. And so this is what it looked like. Over on the left, you can see the Southeast Asia Command, which subsequently was given to Admiral Mountbatten as the commander, with headquarters in Ceylon. And I use the old imperial term because that's what they called it back then. And you can see where the line runs up, so that Sumatra and Malaya are in the Southeast Asia Command. the centre of this map shows MacArthur's playground, Australia, Borneo, Philippines, etc. And then on the right, you get the two glimpses of, firstly, the South Pacific area with New Zealand, New Caledonia and part of the Solomon Islands, and the other Pacific Ocean areas north of the equator, Central Pacific and the North Pacific areas. And so here's Achilles in 1942, photographed in Fiji by the US Navy. And the thing I would like to point out, you can see firstly that there is not much in the way of light anti-aircraft armament. She's still operating the Walrus float plane. But between the foremast and the funnel, there's a light lattice structure, vaguely triangular in shape. And on top of that is the New Zealand-made search radar. We'll see that on both Achilles and Leander. Our scientists had used slightly different style arrays, and because of the limitations of power and all that sort of thing, the radar hut is the block, the square block you see under the little lattice structure. Does that show up? Show up there. And I should make a point about radars. Up until 1943 or beginning of 1944, were not what you're familiar with. You look down at a nice circular screen, the strobe goes around and you see essentially a map as though you're having an aerial view of something. That's the radar I served with and grew up with, etc. I know it's all bloody computerised today. But back then, they didn't have those planned position indicators. You had A and a B scope, and you read off on a bearing dial what direction your radar aerial was pointing, and then you manually plotted the results of those things. So radar was not the smooth and faultless item we know today. There was lots of room for both electronic and human error. And the other point to make about this is the distances, and here we're looking at the bottom right-hand corner, the South Pacific area. Auckland to Fiji, 1,300 miles. Auckland to Tahiti, 2,500 miles. Brisbane to New Caledonia, just under 1,000 miles, 900 miles. The distances are big. And the comparison here, I've put in Gibraltar to Malta, this is half the Mediterranean, was only 1,145 miles. So in essence, Auckland to New Caledonia was the equivalent of half the Mediterranean theatre. And similarly, New Caledonia up to the Solomon Islands and Rabaul, the Japanese base, is the equivalent of the other half of the Mediterranean theatre. The distances are really big. And so here's Leander and the USS Chicago, the US Navy photo from 1942. You'll notice, in contrast to Achilles, that Leander has a very angular camouflage scheme, and that was applied when she was in Alexandria during her Indian Ocean Mediterranean deployment before the Pacific War. So this is a bit crowded, but I'll just try to summarise it for you. The first reaction of the New Zealand Naval Board on the morning of the 8th of December 1941 was to order Achilles to go to Singapore and join, obviously, Prince of Wales and Repulse. By the time she got to Port Moresby for refuelling on the 11th of December, everything had changed. Repulse and Prince of Wales were sunk. So essentially from December, for the next couple of months, they were escorting convoys. And the first one that they were involved in is known as the Pensacola Convoy. It's got a certain notoriety because it was a bunch of American supply ships laden with troops, artillery, aircraft, and their air crews, intended for the Philippines. And as things got a bit more tense in late November 1941, and then everything turned to custard for the Americans on the 7th of December, the Pensacola convoy was either held up, redirected, zigzagged around the place, a lot of uncertainty, and eventually was sent to Brisbane. And so it was the Australian and New Zealand navies that met it and brought it into Brisbane. It wasn't a convoy battle per se, but the ships obviously had to be looked after. Pensacola was the American heavy cruiser that was the convoy commander for this voyage, hence its title. And amongst other things, Achilles escorted a convoy of Australian troops up to Port Moresby. So, for the Royal New Zealand Navy and the Royal Australian Navy, it was second nature to cooperate and integrate with each other. It wasn't so much with the Americans, but they were getting the hang of it. And so with the formation of the Anzac area, the three key positions were Port Moresby, New Caledonia and Fiji. And I must make the point, there were lots of convoys, not big convoys, but hasty convoys, as the Americans tried to create bases throughout the area. Because, of course, the Japanese had knocked everything out that they were used to in their pre-war thinking. And so on the 14th of February, when the carrier Lexington and its related task force was down in the Coral Sea, the decision was taken to attack Rabaul, the big Japanese base, the north end of the Solomons. The Anzac squadron joined it. But typical of the sort of tentative relationship between the navies, the Anzac squadron was detailed off to escort the refueling tankers while the carrier went on to Rabaul. It, however, was detected by Japanese land-based aircraft, came under attack, never attacked Rabaul. Bearing in mind that in February 1942, the power of Japanese land-based aircraft was very feared because they just sunk the Prince of Wales in Repulse. But what that particular raid did happen, the American fighter defence from the Lexington was good, and Lieutenant, I think it was, Butch O'Hare, became an ace in that process. And if you fly into Chicago, it's O'Hare International Airport. So there's a lot going on. The ships are steaming 8 to 10,000 miles per month, which is a lot of time. As I said, on the 22nd of April, MacArthur turns up, Nimitz takes charge in the South Pacific area. And so, as the Battle of the Coral Sea starts to take shape, Achilles and Leander, with three American destroyers, are given control of a specific convoy of American troops and equipment, which is sent to the New Hebrides to establish a base there. And so that was what our ships were doing during the Battle of the Coral Sea. And that one's slightly out of order. And the point to make here is that if you look at the New Hebrides, where our ships will be guarding the convoy and where the battle is fought, there's only about a day's steaming. If things had turned to custard in the Battle of the Coral Sea, the threat to the New Hebrides was quite close. The other point to make is that the strategic focus of the Battle of the Coral Sea is up here where the Japanese troop convoy is, and the Anzac squadron, the Australian and American ships, are here ready to engage them in surface action. And as the Japanese realised Task Force 44 was there, that was why they turned the troop convoy around. The carrier battle was, in a sense, in an important sense, almost incidental. Anyway, a couple more points about distances. So this is it's not a great map, but this was taken from a tourist brochure. It was the only one I could find that covers the right spot. But have we got a...
Yeah, there should be on there.
It's not showing up, is it?
No.
Okay. Anyway, you're familiar with where New Caledonia is. Guadalcanal and the Wall is up here. And obviously Port Moresby and the campaign unfolding there. Vanuatu, New Hebrides, Samoa, etc. Familiar territory, but again, the point is the distances involved. So, compared with London to Berlin, which a bunch of Lancaster bombers flew reasonably regularly on a long winter's night, if you have your fully fueled Lancaster base, say, at Vanuatu, it could reach Guadalcanal and come back. Or if your fully fueled Lancaster was at Guadalcanal, it could reach Rabaul and come back. So the distances are vast relative to the European theatre. And the Guadalcanal campaign itself, after the American success at the Battle of Midway, they were able to take the offensive, and so for 4 months, an intense struggle was fought, which included four night naval battles, a couple of carrier battles, and obviously lots of air raids, but two to point out is the one in January 1943 in which Achilles was bombed, and subsequently another air raid known as the Battle of Rennell Island, when Chicago, after all its struggles with the Anzac Squadron, was finally hit and sunk. And I just note that at the end of January was when our two corvettes, Kiwi and Moa, sank a submarine I-1 off Guadalcanal. The point here is really that by day you fought in the air and you had carrier battles or land-based aircraft. By night they were cruiser-destroyer battles with torpedoes. Nasty, quick, intense, and in the end a huge learning curve for the US and Allied navies. So what did our cruisers do in particular following the Battle of the Coral Sea? More convoys, bringing the US 37th Division to Fiji. Achilles needed a refit. And I'll make the point here that ships are complex, engineering plants are complex. Ships do need refits. So it's not as if a ship can be in the front line all the time, every day of the year. And for the engineering crews, of course, once they sail from Auckland or whatever base, you're driving your steam plant for real. It doesn't matter whether you're in action or not. You've got a ship at sea and you've got to keep that plant going. So Achilles needs a refit. Leander is still escorting convoys. And one of those occasions, it joined an American cruiser task force to escort a convoy all the way into Guadalcanal. Their instructions were unload by sunset and then get the hell out of there. American intelligence was not all that good at this point in September. And so it turned out the night that they sailed out of what's known as Iron Bottom Sound, a Japanese destroyer force came in and bombarded Henderson Field. So they were just a few hours apart of what could have been yet another naval battle. So Leander's working hard through all this, and when it does get detailed off to join another cruiser force in November, that's when they find that the hull is starting to crack. The ship's been running, obviously, since 1939, and she needs to be refitted. Leander goes to Auckland. And what this slide I failed to put in is just underlining the point that Achilles, coming out of refit in November 1942, works up, joins the Americans, is taking part with American cruisers and destroyers in relieving the US Marines off Guadalcanal, and that's when she gets hit and bombed, and X-turret gets destroyed. Now this is just an American photo, but it shows the heavy cruiser HMS Canberra off Tulagi on the day of the Guadalcanal invasion on the 7th of August 1942. So at this point, unknown to them and aboard Canberra, they had another 48 hours to live. So here's the Solomon Islands. And the map's a little distinctive or possibly confusing, but the rectangle is surrounding New Georgia, which we will speak of. And the arrow is not pointing to the rectangle, it's pointing to this body of water, which became known as the Slot, because the Japanese from Rabaul would come down there, steam hard the day before, and then at night time hurtle down the Slot and either try and bring in supplies or sink ships or bombard the airfield. So the Slot was a sort of superhighway for Japanese ships. And the American task, of course, was to meet them and sink them. So after the Battle of Guadalcanal, which finished up in February 1942, there's a few months of what I call a strategic pause. The Japanese and the Americans are both exhausted. And there are, of course, continuing air raids, and then one of those, amongst other ships hit and damaged, there was our corvette Moa was lost. During that period, the Americans were actually running short of aircraft carriers. Their new production hadn't yet ramped up, and their pre-war carriers had mostly been sunk or damaged, so the British loaned them HMS Victorious. And in that period, Leander, out of refit, comes and joins Task Force 18. There are a bunch of landings in June and the beginning of July to take New Georgia, not because they love the island, but because the Japanese had built airfields there. And so that led to two major battles, night naval battles, Kula Gulf and then Kolombangara. So here's Victorious, refueling for an American tanker, and the arrangement was she operated in company with the USS Saratoga. The arrangement was the Saratoga operated all the strike aircraft, the Avenger torpedo bombers, and Victorious, who the British fighter control system. The point with Victorious is the British had perfected or had a much better fighter control system. So Victorious had about 60 Grumman Wildcats, both British and American, on board, and she provided fighter cover for the task force during the New Georgia landings. And there's a closer up image. So the landings are here on Rendova and up here. Now there's the Munda airstrip. But the naval battles are out here. This is Kula Gulf and Kolombangara Island. So the naval battles are in the slot. And there's three of the cruisers. The third one is in the distance in the background. And the Battle of Kula Gulf, they get involved with four destroyers against a Japanese force consisting of two transport units, destroyers crowded with troops, and three destroyers not crowded with troops. And some of you may be aware that the Japanese had the Long Lance torpedo, 24 inches in diameter. The Allied ones were 21 inches. But the turbine in the torpedo was powered by pure oxygen, whereas British and American torpedoes were powered by compressed air. To burn the fuel that drove the turbine, that sent the torpedo through the water. And so the Japanese Long Lance torpedoes were faster, bigger, and much longer range. And in July 1943, the Allies still did not know about it. It was one of the intelligence failures for the Allies, and it was only during 1943, as I understand it, that one of the torpedoes came up on a beach that the Americans found it and finally took it apart and saw what the secret was. So the point is that these destroyers are powerfully armed for a night engagement, and the upshot was that in the space of less than half an hour, when the American task force met the Japanese destroyers, the Helena was sunk and the transport units landed their troops. So a Japanese victory. Here's Helena, quite an impressive looking ship, nominally a light cruiser. And this is one of the destroyers after that battle with survivors of the Helena aboard. But I also point out that if you're in a Japanese destroyer with half a battalion of troops on board, you would look a bit the same. Troops all over the upper deck. In a destroyer, there's not much room between decks. And so that led, after the Battle of Kula Gulf, the Admiral at the time wanted more reinforcements, so Leander replaced the Helena, joined Honolulu, St. Louis. He got some more destroyers, and of course, this is all happening day after day, so by the 11th they hear that there's another Tokyo Express coming, and this time it has the Jinsu, a light cruiser, at the head of it. 1,200 troops, sort of two battalions worth, and destroyers. The whole battle, I'm not going to talk about the battle in great detail, but basically it had at 1 a.m. a 15-minute encounter in which Leander got torpedoed and Jinsu got sunk, and then at 2 a.m. a second brief encounter, which no Japanese got sunk, and the two big American cruisers were both torpedoed, and one of their destroyers was torpedoed and sunk. So these are fast-moving actions, 15 minutes of frantic fighting, and at the end you're either swimming in the water or your ship's away scot-free. So as I say, unlike something like the Battle of the River Plate, which takes days to unfold, these are sorted out, and before it's 3 a.m, you're either dead or alive. This is the class of ship that Jinsu belonged to. The Japanese had built them in the 1920s based very much on the British World War I C and D class cruisers. However, in the 1930s, they upgraded them and, amongst other things, put on the long lance torpedoes. And this is a rather rare colour photo of USS St. Louis, and I believe it is either before Kula Gulf or Kolam Banggara. But here she is leaving the Tulagi anchorage, which is across the water from Guadalcanal. And Leander, by 1943, has got additional 20mm guns. You'll see there's one mounted above B turret, the second turret there. The others are slightly visible if we blew up the photo. She's still got a pre-war mast array. But the other thing of note, and you don't see the search radar in front of the funnel that I pointed out before, but above the anti-aircraft director, before the first yardarm of the foremast, there's a very light electronic-looking array, which I understand was their gunnery ranging radar. Again, New Zealand-built radar. And this photo, the US Navy Historical Centre tells me, is indeed from Honolulu, with Leander as the second ship, and St. Louis astern, heading off to the Battle of Kolam Banggara. Now, as I say, ship's got torpedoed. So firstly, here's USS St. Louis, limped back to the New Hebrides, and the repair ship Vestal is going to work on the bow. You can see the giant bite taken out. This is another view of her bow. By this time, she's all the way back at California, and you can see the immense power. The whole bow, notwithstanding that half a chunk of it is missing, has been bent sideways, and that's a big explosion. Very fortunate, though, because there aren't many crew members there, so most, you know, the casualty list was quite light. Honolulu, however, lost its bow entirely. So this is the fore part of Honolulu, the what we would call A and B turrets. The light space at the left-hand edge is, in fact, the edge of a repair barge. It's not a hole. But you can see that a lot of folks are bent down, anchor cables and whatnot trailing into the water. Again, lucky to be hit at the bow, not too many people, and again, not near just the guns' magazines. And so here's Honolulu, subsequently with a temporary bow, limping her way back to California. Meanwhile, Leander, of course, gets temporary repairs at Tulagi and at the New Hebrides, and makes her way back to Auckland, enters our familiar Calliope dock, and here's the torpedo hole, and there is a person, hard to make out, but you can see it's a dockyard mate of some kind here. So that's a pretty bloody big hole, and at this point they've obviously painted in the various bulkheads to show it. So Leander's survival is in fact quite a positive record of damage control. All three ships were doing well in terms of keeping their ships afloat that night. So because of that, we've got Achilles bombed, and we've got Leander torpedoed, and so Achilles by this time is back in the UK, and she goes into Portsmouth Dockyard for repair, and in fact, one night, presumably accidentally, a dockyard matey an acetylene tank spends the night leaking, filling a compartment with acetylene gas. They come on board in the morning to get welding and cutting again, light their torches, and the whole thing goes up. Huge damage for Achilles, but a valuable ship that you can't get rid of. So she winds up with another, I think it's 11 months in dockyard hands. So Achilles is out, Leander is obviously going to be out, and the decision was taken that we would take on the new cruiser, Gambia. She had been in service for about a year. She was undergoing a refit, and so Achilles' crew, in the most part, went over and took over Gambia. And as you can see there, from October 1943, she's under trials, undertakes a workup with the British Home Fleet, and then in December 1944, she's based in Plymouth, and on patrol against German blockade runners. And let me just underline, this is the North Atlantic in midwinter. So pretty arduous conditions for Gambier. She was in fact placed in command of a cruiser destroyer force. They didn't manage to engage and sink some German destroyers, but they were done by Glasgow and Enterprise, two other cruisers, and Gambier in charge of the force was 100 miles away, very frustrated that because of the weather they couldn't get there in time. So they didn't have action themselves, but the captain had been in command of the group. Gambier, of course, is a New Zealand manned ship, commissioned as HMNZS Gambier, but as part of the Admiralty's arrangement, still under the control of the Admiralty, who nonetheless are sympathetic that it's a New Zealand ship, so she gets sent to the Eastern Fleet and arrives there in February 1944, based in Trincomalee, Ceylon. At the bottom of the slide, I've put the Canberra Pact, which was an agreement between Australia and New Zealand about post-war influence in the Pacific Islands. They were a little worried with the flood of Americans into the South Pacific and into Papua New Guinea and into what was sort of traditionally our territory, that they wanted to have a say in it. So this pact was written for that. Although the British were sort of understanding of it, the Americans immediately got offside. And one result of the Canberra Pact was an unwritten rule to the US armed forces that New Zealand and Australian forces will not come north of the equator. And this was particularly intended to prevent the Australian army from getting beyond Papua New Guinea or Bougainville. So notwithstanding the warm alliance, there were some practical diplomatic realities that the Americans, as we well know, can play hardball about, and this is one of them. Not many people have written about it. Gerald Hensley, in his book about the diplomatic war effort, touches on it. That somehow, and I think we're going to blame the Australians, they managed to get offside with the State Department in Washington, and it had a very practical effect on the RNZAF, which never got beyond Bougainville, and on the Australian deployments. Anyway, better news. Here's the Gambier. Big ship, 12 6-inch guns, and you can see there's that big bar above the bridge, which is a canvas cover of the gunnery ranging radar. There are other radars visible, lots of anti-aircraft guns, and the colour scheme, there's a big long blue panel down the hull, and that was the colour scheme provided to pretty much the British Pacific Fleet. I think it was described as an Admiralty intermediate pattern. And the idea, of course, is if you're in your U-boat looking at it at close range through the waves down by the surface, the blue panel would make you a little uncertain as to was the ship closer or not, or was that a ship in front, or it was a more subtle camouflage than the more disruptive ones that we saw earlier. So Gambier, having left the Atlantic, comes over to the Eastern Fleet, based in Ceylon, and undertakes a number of raids and a variety of other duties. So she's in frontline service. And in that period, the Americans loaned the carrier USS Saratoga to the Eastern Fleet, working alongside Illustrious as the British carrier aviators got used to the American way of doing things. So she is significant. Now this is a glimpse of Trincomalee Harbour, which became a major base, HMS Renown, HMS Illustrious Visible. And when Saratoga left the Eastern Fleet to return to California and a refit, there's a sort of formal sail pass. This isn't a brilliant photo, captures Gambier in silhouette, but it shows that the Americans all mustered on the flight deck to give three cheers to the ships they'd been working with. You can actually find this on YouTube in colour from the Americans' perspective as the Eastern Fleet or most of its sails pass. My technology wasn't good enough to put it on screen for you. But it's worth a look because it's also a rare colour film. So Gambier is successfully by this time in New Zealand, undergoing a brief refit, and Achilles will lead through what happens to her. So she gets a long, extensive refit. On the 3rd of June, she's told to get out of Portsmouth. We happen to have an invasion going on. And so she goes up to Glasgow and then to Scapa Flow. Having worked up, she's assigned to Operation Dragoon, the invasion of southern France. Doesn't do anything really dramatic, but she is part of that operation, and then continues through the Mediterranean to join the Eastern Fleet. And it's a relatively quiet period for Achilles, but as I say, she's there with a frontline fleet, and amongst her duties, she escorts troop ships to Australia, undertakes an unplanned firefighting effort in Fremantle when a freighter catches fire and endangers the harbour, and amongst other people, escorted Australia's first Royal Governor-General to Sydney. And the upshot is she arrives in Auckland in February 1945. Now this is Achilles after the refit. Very different ship. Tripod mast, radars on top. She had twice the heavy anti-aircraft armament, from 4 4-inch to 4 twin 4-inch. A very heavy light anti-aircraft armament, including where X turret was. That's the second turret before the stern. There are now two multiple pom-pom anti-aircraft guns. You can even see right at the stern there are placements for, and I understand it was a Bofors, 40mm Bofors gun. And the biggest thing, I guess, is that instead of having a single anti-aircraft position behind the bridge, she now has two anti-aircraft directors, one on either side of the bridge, and this is a long-range air warning radar, and that same basic radar was still in service when I joined the Navy. On different ships, of course, but the technology and the displays are all the same. And so here's the battleship Howe, leading three destroyers, two of which are Australian, and Achilles at the end of the line into Auckland. And that's what Devonport Dockyard looked like then. Wish it could look like that now. So there's Achilles and Gambier and two of the destroyers visible alongside. Quite a respectable fleet for the Auckland setting. And after Howe, which was primarily there for diplomacy and for Admiral Fraser of the British Pacific Fleet to meet the New Zealand government, they do some public exercises in the Hauraki Gulf with Gambier, who is now out of refit. One of the points you might like about Howe, so these are 14-inch guns, and there's a whole nest of 20mm Oerlikons, because the British obviously were heading to Japanese waters, and they knew that lots of anti-aircraft guns are good. So the British Pacific Fleet. Now, bearing in mind that Australia and New Zealand are sort of very subtly, and nobody said anything out loud, but they're not going to come north of the equator. Once President Roosevelt accepts a British Pacific Fleet, the British Pacific Fleet is formed at Ceylon. Its first major strike is against oil refineries in Sumatra, and then it bases itself in Sydney. So Gambier has joined the fleet, and on the 1st of March they leave the fleet and sail north to assist in the invasion of Okinawa. And Achilles catches up during April. Now this is a little sketch. So you can see Formosa, Taiwan today. Japan is to the north of this sketch, above the water snake. And the islands, Miyako, Ishigaki and Uromote, were stepping stones for Japanese aircraft to fly from Formosa to attack the Americans at Okinawa. And at the same time, Japanese aircraft based in Japan, in the southern islands of Japan itself, would fly south to attack the Americans at Okinawa. And of course, by this time, the kamikaze tactic is in use. Not every air raid was a kamikaze air raid, but enough of them were. While the American 5th Fleet sat off Okinawa supporting the invasion, the British Fleet, Pacific Fleet, is there south of Ishigaki and it has a flying off position where you fly the strikes from, and then they retreat out of the area for a couple of hundred miles to meet the refueling ships. So these ships are operating off Okinawa. They're based in Sydney. They have a forward base at the Admiralty Islands, which I failed to point out, which is just a wee bit north of New Guinea. And then there's a long haul of about 4,000 miles across the Pacific to get to the actual operating area. So this is the first time that the Royal Navy is operating on an sustained oceanic basis. And so it was a learning curve for the British and Commonwealth navies all round. And this is what it would look like during an air raid. So that might be Gambia, I don't know, but under the big explosion cloud is HMS Formidable, an aircraft carrier. You can see the sky is filled with flak. The water is erupting with either spent rounds or shrapnel. And somewhere in the heart of that explosion, of course, was a kamikaze. So this was the sort of scene when you're under air attack and you're operating in a big fleet and it's a serious business. Apparently the typical time between detecting it, not with radar, but your visual detection, because if you're operating an Oerlikon gun, you're going to be looking through the sights, to sight a kamikaze before it hits is about 11 seconds. So your reaction time is pretty bloody limited, and you really hope that the defending air patrol will have shot them down before that. And so this is the sort of thing that went on. The invasion of Okinawa was Operation Iceberg. So for the British, there was Iceberg 1, which was a month-long effort, had a week-long break actually in the Philippines, and then another effort to the south of Okinawa before Okinawa was declared secured and that campaign is over. So after Iceberg 1 and 2, Gambia goes to refit in Sydney. Implacable, a new aircraft carrier on the block, and I should make the point that a significant number of New Zealanders were aircrew in the Fleet Air Arm. Implacable has come to the Pacific, so Achilles and a couple of other cruisers shepherded up to Truk, which had not been invaded. It was part of the islands that were hopped over, bypassed by the Americans, and they had a couple of days practice, both airstrikes and shore bombardment against the poor Japanese garrison still left at Truk. And then on the 21st of June, the whole force leaves Sydney and sails for Japanese home waters, as you can see there. So Gambia and Achilles are both involved. Now this is a carrier Implacable with the Seafire's range for launch. A point to note, not caring about the time at the moment, point to note is that they've all got drop tanks, which was unusual for Spitfires, but the Fleet Air Arm raided drop tanks off the US Army Air Force, and when they gave their Seafires the drop tanks, they had useful range, and they could fly over and strike at targets in Japan. Replenishment C, as I touch on, was important. The carrier on the left is Implacable or Indefatigable. They had distinctive gun turrets. I don't know the name of the oiler. And the destroyer, I believe, is HMS Ulysses. Not the novel by Alistair MacLean. The Australians came with to the British Pacific Fleet, not with their cruisers, which still belonged to the 7th Fleet down in the Philippines, but they too had manned some British-built N-class destroyers. So this is HMAS Nizam, which I think is the rank of a Middle Eastern potentate, I'm not sure. But what's curious about this, suiting it for action against kamikazes, is that they've got landed their torpedo tubes, no torpedoes there, and two extra Bofors guns, and another one up here. And so even at the destroyers, they're very much reinforcing their anti-aircraft armament and sacrificing things such as the torpedoes. And this is a view of Sydney, which I find rather interesting. The time, this must have been very soon, August or September 45, because the cruiser Belfast has arrived and is at anchor here.
There are two aircraft carriers, and this is a Dutch cruiser, the Tromp.
The Dutch, of course, were not part of the British Pacific Fleet. You know, colonialism or allies only go so far when you've got colonies to liberate. But anyway, a view of Sydney and looking like a very serious naval base. A hospital ship in the foreground, as you can see. And Achilles, again, at Sydney. And this is, I've been able to sort of ascertain what her armament by this time was. So in addition to the 4-inch guns and the British-built pom-pom guns, 5 Beauforts and 10 Oerlikons. So a pretty respectable armament. So with this view of Japan, and the point again to make is the distance from Sydney, from the forward operating base in the Admiralty Islands, all the way up to the coast of Japan. Not only the combat ships, but the supply ships had to be there. And amongst the supply ships, or the fleet train, was a little New Zealand corvette, Arbutus, which had been redesignated and equipped as a radar repair ship. So the little Arbutus was there, 400 miles from Tokyo, taking its part in the final operations. I have read that in those final months, bearing in mind that there are B-29 raids going on, and the US Army Air Force was starting to fly against Japan from Okinawa, and the entire 5th or 3rd Fleet was off the coast flying its strikes from carriers, that the Empress of Japan at the time commented that she could cope with the bomber air raids, but she didn't like those naval fighters, because of course they had the time and energy to come down strafing and actually shooting up the enemy with great enthusiasm. And so when I stumbled across that little gem, I thought it gave a little vivid picture of life under an air in a country under constant air raids. So she didn't like the naval fighters. So here's Achilles in that final rig, as you can see, with the paint scheme, the additional light anti-aircraft guns. And here we'll come to our friends, the Canadians. So this is HMCS Uganda, which was acquired on much the same basis as we had Gambia, a sister ship. She was coming along for the side for a replenishment at sea. She looked pretty battered and sea-worn, but these are ships hard at work. And the story behind the Canadian cruisers is that they had not much of a navy up until about 1939. They focused on the Atlantic and building frigates and corvettes for the anti-submarine war. And in 1944, they realised they might need a navy for diplomatic purposes. So they took over HMCS Uganda. She got deployed to the British Pacific Fleet. In April 1945, with the war coming to an end in Europe, the Canadian Parliament said, oh, you have to volunteer if you want to fight against the Japanese. And so the ship's company of Uganda were invited to vote, and 600 of them said, no, I've had a long enough war, I'd like to go home, please. So they did. On the way home, of course, they had to refuel at Pearl Harbor. The Americans did not like them. And in fact, Uganda was replaced by the converted armed merchant cruiser, HMCS Prince Robert, but by that time the war was over. And their other cruiser, Ontario, commissioned only late, and so she too joined the British Pacific Fleet for the prisoner return and so on and so forth. So Uganda's story is a bit blemished. So here we are, Tokyo Bay, September 1945, the British flagship Duke of York at right, and Gambia stayed on in that immediate period after the surrender as part of the Allied landing force and the Yokosuka naval base, and amongst other things, they liberated the Japanese flag, or the naval flag. So that completes my tale. It's been a bit hasty and it's probably been a bit long, but there you are.
Excellent. Questions. I'm sure the bus has plenty of questions. A lot to take in.
And one of the photos there you had where that ship had the bow blown off, yeah, and the anchor chains were hanging over. Yeah. It looked like a straight cut. It wasn't a jagged or anything. Had it been repaired before?
No. In that photo, the hull underneath has been blown out,
yeah.
And the deck and a bit of the deck plating was there, but not strong enough to stay parallel. So the deck has folded down. Yeah. No, these torpedoes were very powerful to blow the bow off those cruisers.
Thanks.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, the point with all those night naval actions in 1942 and 1943, as I say, they would build up to the encounter, the Japanese coming from the north, the American or allies coming from the south. Somebody would detect the other sooner or later. The Americans had the advantage of radar, and as I say, the radar displays were not nice, neat and easy to read. That started to change. You were manually plotting things, but then they would have to see and sight the enemy visually. In the case of the Jinsu, which was sunk in part by the end, they turned on a searchlight, which is a very silly thing to do, because all the other gunners of the American and British and New Zealand gunners sighted on it and started blasting the searchlight and the ship underneath it to help, which happened. The difficult part is they couldn't necessarily see the destroyers which were launching torpedoes. Yes?
The Japanese Navy was a lot more practiced in night actions before the war, and it took quite some time for the Americans to catch up.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. No, that was one of the things that they... The Japanese pre-war had been looking for any advantage because the treaty system, the naval treaties, meant that they were only 60% of the US Navy. So they were looking to get every advantage for each ship. So slightly bigger torpedoes, slightly faster speed, or in the case of battleships, bigger guns, that sort of thing. Yeah, at night, and they did practice intensively at night. Yeah.
Right, any, yeah.
Those vessels equipped with torpedo batteries in the midsection of the ships, would those be used primarily against other vessels or submarines?
No, they were for use against other surface ships. They were not anti-submarine torpedoes. These torpedoes were big, fair bit of fuel, as they compressed air burning kerosene, or in the case of the Japanese, oxygen, burning kerosene to drive the turbine. So they were fast, 40 knots or so, and you tried to get long range from them. But of course, the further the torpedo has to travel, the more the target ship has a chance to avoid it, not always successfully. So a lot of torpedo action is at surface actions at quite close range, 2 to 4,000 yards. In the Battle of the River Plate, Achilles fired torpedoes at the Graf Spee at about 8,000 yard range, and I don't think Graf Spee ever even saw them.
Look, I'm mindful of the time. Are there any sort of final questions that anybody has for Richard before we conclude? No? Well, look, once again, Richard, thanks very much. I know this one's been a bit of a strenuous exercise to get it all together, and there's a huge amount of information there, which we're going to upload anyway to the website. So if you want to go back, or if you've got other friends, colleagues who want to have a look at the presentation who couldn't make it today, then certainly we'll have that, both the audio and the PowerPoint presentation, on our website. Grateful thanks to Richard, to Stuart, who's doing the audio recording, and also our friends from the City Library for hosting this session. So a final round of applause. Thanks.